Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. 20 years ago, we ended welfare as we know it. The question, though, is what do we really know about welfare today at all? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Friday is upon us, April the 29th. Glad to have you along, as always, everybody. It has been a week in the economic big picture. It has so much to digest, so little time. So here to unpack the 5 days gone by, we've got Catherine Rampell from The Washington Post. John Carney is with The Wall Street Journal. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai.
Hi, Kai.
All right, John, you get to go first today. Take a swing past Janet Yellen and the Federal Reserve. Met this week. Nothing on interest rates, obviously. Read the tea leaves. 30 seconds. Go.
Sure. They communicated very clearly that if there's not some big economic slowdown between now and the next meeting, that there's a good chance that they will raise rates at the next meeting.
Catherine Rampell, make the case for me that when they meet in June, we all ought to just ignore the Fed, even if they do raise rates, because still going from, you know, 0.25% to 0.5% is not so much anyway.
Yeah, I mean, in absolute terms, it's not that big of a deal. I think where it could matter more is more symbolically, that it's a sign of optimism. This is why, in my view, they were sort of obligated to raise rates in December, even though there had been a bunch of data that was kind of squishy, not so optimistic,
right.
But that at the time they had put out these signals indicating that they were ready to raise rates. And if they didn't, then that would just send this signal to the market that there was like they were anticipating doom and gloom. And this time around, arguably, if they hold off again, people might interpret the same thing.
Are they still, John, prisoners of their own past verbiage, if I could, you know, coin a phrase?
Well, I don't think so. I think they've actually been intentionally building a market expectation that they will raise rates. I think they could have held off for even longer, but we've had a number of speeches and then the statement, which took a more hawkish tone about the economy.
Mm-hmm.
So I think they're actually trying – they're worried that people were underestimating the chances of a raise in June, and I think now that's gone. People think, yeah, okay, we're going to get a raise.
All right. One of the things the Fed and Chair Yellen specifically have been talking about, Catherine, is the idea that they're keeping an eye on the global economy and that, you know, the rest of the world is not doing as well as we are. And yet, first quarter gross domestic product here came in the other day at 0.5%. The Eurozone is growing at 0.6%. All terrible,
right.
But they're better than we are. What?
Yes. Everybody looks like – well, China's slowing down, too. You didn't even mention that.
Well, we're going to get there in a minute, but go ahead.
Yeah. Well, everything looks kind of disappointing at this point, I would say. But the last I had seen, we're still pretty much on track in terms of the annual expected growth rate with what the Fed had been expecting before. So it's still not great, but it's, you know, we're not in a recession. Things are chugging along. There are some other indicators to suggest that the headwinds that we saw the first quarter of this year will abate and things will get better.
So, John, one quarter does not a trend make?
It doesn't. Although, you know, who would have thought that you would ever see the Fed raise rates when, you know, one quarter after a 0.5 growth rate?
Right.
That's incredible.
That's what I'm saying. All right. So let's get to China here, Catherine. I want to do it in the guise of Apple, not, they had a slowdown in revenues and all this stuff. But that's their second biggest market. It's the second biggest economy on the planet. There are some signs of trouble. Carl Icahn, the big investor, has dumped his Apple holdings. How worried should we all be about China not having that soft landing that we're all counting on?
I think pretty worried, and I don't know that a lot of people are counting on that soft landing.
Hmm.
And I would also point out that Icahn indicated that he dumped Apple shares not just because of the macro concerns in China, but also the geopolitical concerns. Like they've effectively forced out a lot of other international companies, and there's some risk of that there. But the problem with prognosticating about China is that the data are so opaque. It's very hard to know how big of a grain of salt, not just if you should have a grain of salt, but how big of a grain of salt you should take with any of the numbers that they're releasing, because they're very cognizant as well about people freaking out about the softness or hardness of their landing.
Right. Catherine Rempel at The Washington Post, John Carney at The Wall Street Journal. Thanks, y'all. Have a good weekend.
Thanks, Guy.
All right.
Thanks.
Talk to you soon. Wall Street today did end better than it looked like it was gonna. That's about all you can say for that today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Sometimes being the first company into a space doesn't really matter. Maybe the original innovation you came up with wasn't good enough, or maybe the competition just figured out how to do what you were doing better and you've kind of become an afterthought. I mention that because TiVo has been sold, the company that first really popularized the idea of digital video recording, the ubiquitous unbranded DVRs that we all have today. The buyer for a cool $1 billion, touch more actually, is the TV technology company Rovi. Between them, the two companies have 6,000 issued or pending patents because, as Marketplace's Adrian Hill reports, everything is all about keeping up with the rapidly changing ways that we are watching television.
There was a time not that long ago when TiVo was so cutting edge that it was a verb, as in, I TiVo'd the Janet Jackson Super Bowl halftime show.
It's remarkable how quickly the TV upstart, you know, TiVo, is now no longer relevant.
James McQuivey is a media analyst at Forrester Research. No longer as relevant to viewers, he says, but still very valuable, regardless of the future of the set-top box.
TiVo's accumulated a whole bunch of patents over these many years.
Patents that cover things like user analytics, moving and storing digital content. Rovi holds significant television patents too, related to online TV guides, user experience. A combined TiVo-Rovi, which will be called TiVo, could create technology that is hyper-personalized and takes into account
where you are, what amount of time that you have to view something, and what kind of content you're likely to want to watch at that particular moment in that particular circumstance.
That's IHS analyst Tom Morad. He says the future viewing experience isn't about what the technology will let me do, but what the technology will do for me on all my screens.
It's almost like, you know, a close friend is controlling the TV or controlling your video or experience of entertainment on your behalf. So you don't have to do anything.
Creepy? A little. But that's part of the vision behind the tie-up, and a vision that a whole lot of other companies like cable, Netflix, and Hulu are working on at the same time. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
If you've had an eye on cable news or social media at all today, you saw yet another indication that for the first time in a really long while, California is going to matter in the presidential primaries this year. Protesters blocking a hotel entrance at a Donald Trump rally up in Northern California forced the candidate and his security detail out of their SUVs and onto the roadway shoulder on foot to get into the venue through the back door. Set actual delegate counts aside for a minute, though, and let's talk dollars and cents, because politicking doesn't get any more expensive than it does out here. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore reports.
So many unexpected things in this campaign cycle, and to the list you can add California.
This is probably the first time that a California presidential primary will make a definitive difference since the 1972 Democratic presidential primary.
Dan Schnur is director of the Jesse Unruh Institute of Politics at USC. Usually by now, the winners of the national primaries are pretty much figured out, and they can just snooze right on through California's June primary. But on the Republican side, especially, things are not quite figured out, which means the state's 172 Republican delegates have suddenly become very important. One problem, campaigning in California is very expensive.
It costs upwards of $1 million a week in order to have a significant advertising buy in the state of California.
Trump gets a lot of airtime for free, and he could just write a check if he needed to.
But for Ted Cruz, and certainly for John Kasich, neither one of them had budgeted for a California primary because there was really no way to anticipate that the primary season would last this long.
Whatever spent now will eat into resources for the general election. It also turns out that the newly important California primary is having a domino effect, raising campaign costs all the way down the ballot in the state.
Because turnout will be high.
Erica Walters is a partner at California-based campaign consulting firm Terrace, Barnes & Walters. When turnout is high, campaigns have to spend more on direct mail and other targeted non-TV outreach.
I mean, I have candidates that are easily going to be spending 20% more. It's a scramble because not everyone saw this coming.
Surprise, America. It's the primary that just won't die. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace. Coming up,
infect welfare recipients with a positive attitude, with the beauty and glory of work.
How that guy in California helped change welfare as we used to know it. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials gave up 57 points on this Friday, the last trading day of the month. 0.3%, ended at 17,773. The NASDAQ down 30 points, 0.6%, 4775. The S&P 500 off 10 points, 0.5%, 2065. For the week, the Dow off 1.2%, the NASDAQ down 2.6%, the S&P 500 dropped 0.2%. B&G Foods. It makes products under brand names including Grandma's Molasses and Molly McButter, posted strong profits and thus jumped 23%. The Select Comfort Corporation is known for Sleep Number beds. Also beat profit forecast. Select Comfort's number was up 21%. Amazon reported strong results after yesterday's close. And today, Amazon up 9.5%. Jeff Bezos worth another gazillion dollars. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note fell to 1.83%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. 20 years ago this coming August, President Clinton signed what's officially known as the Personal Responsibility and Work Opportunity Reconciliation Act of 1996. More colloquially, it was welfare reform, one of the key campaign promises that Bill Clinton had made as a candidate and which is still seen as one of his big domestic policy achievements. With that 20 years of hindsight, then, our Chrissy Clark has been digging deep into what effect welfare reform has actually had and is here to tell us about it. Hey, Chrissy.
Hey, Kai, I have this CD that I really want to play for you, and I promise that it will all make sense in just a minute.
Okay, so music CD? Music?
Yes,
all
music.
Right, music, here we go. This is amazing. This is amazing. First of all, you're dancing to it in the studio, which is a whole different thing. What is that music? Where did it come from?
I know. It is so deeply stuck in my head at this point. So this is basically an archaeological artifact from the years leading up to welfare reform. It was made in the early 90s. And I have a copy of the CD that I brought in to show you.
All right. So it's called Work Makes the Difference, Riverside County Department of Public Social Services, copyright 1993. Wow. County Riverside, California. So who are they? Where did this come from?
This is basically the staff of a county welfare office.
Huh.
And they produced and wrote the songs and performed on this CD.
Wow. We will, I am sure, get back to this CD in a minute. But there's some context here, right? Because we've had cash welfare in this country for a long, long time. Like, it was part of the Social Security Act back in FDR's days, the whole deal.
Yeah, 1935, right. It was passed into law as part of the sweeping set of safety net programs that FDR signed. And the whole point of this one program was specifically to help poor single mothers out.
Hmm.
The idea was that we wanted to help them stay out of the workforce.
Which is not the way it works today, right? I mean, there's work requirements before you get a check, the whole, I mean, lots.
Right. In the 80s and 90s, we started to do this flip where the whole debate became not how to keep women out of the workforce so they could raise their kids, mm-hmm. but how to get women on welfare into the workplace. Actually, it turns out a lot of them were already working, but it wasn't a requirement for welfare.
And that actually is why you're here. We're going to be talking about the consequences of those policies in a series over the next couple of weeks. And also a whole new podcast from Wealth and Poverty. Yes.
Yes. It just came out. We're calling it The Uncertain Hour.
Ooh.
And this season, we're going to be asking the question, 20 years after we, quote, ended welfare as we know it, what the heck is welfare now? And we'll be hearing from lots of different voices over the course of the series, from people on welfare to people who wish they were on welfare. But to start things off today, I want to get you into the minds of some of the early reformers of welfare, which brings us to the story of that CD and the man behind it.
My name is Lawrence Townsend.
Larry, for short. He's got close-cropped white hair and one of those army general smiles that never quite turns up at the edges. Today, Larry is 79, retired. He lives in a beach town in California where he drives around in a green Cadillac Seville with a brass frame around the license plate. And etched into the brass, it says,
"Life works if you work."
Larry loves work. Just the idea of it. It's one of the two main concepts that define his worldview. The second thing that defines Larry, as much as he loves work, he hates welfare. It's his other obsession.
I've seen so much damage to people that are on welfare. They have no hope for a better future. They aren't setting a good example for their children.
And he's got a collection of stories devoted to this belief. Anecdotes that date back decades to his early career in county government, like the one about his visit to a welfare office where he saw two kids waiting for their mom in the lobby, playing pretend.
One of the children was playing the welfare recipient. The other one was playing the eligibility worker. Now you tell me they aren't learning how to get on welfare. That one causes tears still.
This is the kind of anecdote that gets told and retold among critics of welfare. An individual moment that may not be typical of welfare recipients in general, but for critics represents all the failings of the system. But what makes Larry's anecdotes unique? 2 decades ago, he was in a position to do something about them because he became the head of a welfare department in a big suburban county east of L.A. called Riverside. The way he saw it, his role in this welfare office?
To invade and conquer. That was my attitude.
And in the late 80s, he got the perfect chance to wage his war. At the time, the government was reconsidering its approach to cash welfare for poor families. But then the question was, how? And Larry Townsend had some ideas.
I was absolutely stunned that I was given freedom to design a program, to implement a program. It was an opportunity to change the concept of welfare.
Larry's changes happened under a pilot program in California called Greater Avenues for Independence, GAIN for short. There were 2 basic avenues county welfare offices could experiment with. Some went the education and training route. The idea was to help poor single moms who'd often dropped out of school get more skills, maybe a GED, to fare better on the job market. Larry did not have much patience for that approach. His approach in Riverside, much simpler and cheaper.
Get people into a job immediately.
Just don't worry about, are you trained enough or do you have enough education? Just get that job.
We're not going to train you for years. We're not going to send you to school for years. We're going to show you how to find a job.
You can still hear the conviction in Larry's voice almost 30 years later. Listen to that.
How to find a job.
And the point of this job-first approach wasn't to find the perfect job or even a very well-paying job.
But at least your foot is in the door, and how well you succeed from there is up to you.
With one important catch.
If you do not cooperate with us, we will take you off of welfare.
To carry out his jobs-first plan, Larry restructured his welfare office to run job search classes and job clubs.
I remember being at the GAIN office and they
Sophia Elsman had just signed up for welfare in Riverside at the time. She'd grown up poor. Her family had been on welfare when she was a child. And now that she and her husband had just split up, she needed some help supporting her kids while she looked for a job and got her life back together. Her intake worker said she'd need to enroll in the GAIN pilot program.
They said it's to get you out there in the workplace, which was fine with me. Because that's what I wanted to do anyways. You know, I've been working since I was 14 years old.
Sophia says there were workshops on finding jobs.
How to fill out applications, how to do interviews.
They'd get a list of leads, she says, and be told to start calling around. There was kind of a Weight Watchers vibe to it. When they landed an interview, people would cheer. But all this was just the beginning of Larry Townsend's plans for the welfare recipients of Riverside. Larry's vision was much bigger.
Infect welfare recipients with a positive attitude, with the beauty and glory of work. And so I became sort of like a preacher for work.
And a preacher needs tools to evangelize.
I have a few materials that I can show you. Booklets, posters, billboards.
Almost 30 years later, Larry still has his files.
There's some that I wanted to show you.
All the marketing ephemera his office made, full of welfare to work slogans.
Success stands on your backbone, not your wishbone. Action turns dreams into realities. Get into gear. Start a career.
I am the difference.
Self-sufficiency is supporting
yourself. A person
who aims at nothing has a target he can't miss.
Be proud of honest labor.
Don't wait for your ship to come in. Swim out to it.
Going through Larry's archives is like walking through a gift shop at a national landmark commemorating work. There are souvenirs of every variety designed to appeal to as many of a welfare recipient's senses as possible. Messages printed on bumper stickers, on buttons, messages you could see, you could touch. And for the ears, well, there was this.
I thought music is a very inspirational form of communication.
And so Larry made that CD that you heard a bit of before, called Work Makes the Difference. He used $2,000 of taxpayer money, no authorization, to record it.
And I figured I might get fired over it.
But he didn't. This is the first track, the title track.
Will your children be the next generation? Or will you be the last? Welfare's temporary, not a way of life. Be proud of honest labor, have dignity and pride.
The music was made to be played in welfare waiting rooms over the PA system, to be the hold music when people called up the welfare office. It would play during voicemail greetings. There are 10 songs in all, different genres to appeal to different demographics, Larry says. There's a song that features a whole rap section.
Supporting yourself is helping yourself. You've got to have some dignity and pride.
And then there's a jazzy Andrew Sisters sort of 40s thing that is very hard not to snap your fingers to. And whether it was the songs themselves, or the buttons, the billboards, the bumper stickers, the job clubs, or just the job-first strategy altogether, somehow Larry's plan in Riverside seemed to work.
The results in Riverside were the most impressive we had ever seen in a welfare-to-work program up to that time.
This is sociologist James Riccio. He was actually hired by the government to study Riverside's Jobs First program. Turns out the families who participated in it, 5 years later, they were doing way better than the ones who stayed on the plain old welfare program where they just got checks, no job clubs or job pep talks. The Job First folks had more jobs. They were making more money. They were also doing better than the people on welfare who lived in other parts of the state and got the education-first strategy instead. And because of all of this,
Larry Townsend, the director, became a kind of star in this narrow world of welfare reform.
But this narrow world was about to widen and play a very big role on the national stage. And Larry's get-a-job, any-job approach for welfare recipients became known as
Riverside Miracle.
A miracle that paved the way for the Federal Welfare Reform Bill that was signed into law in 1996 and ended welfare as we know it. There's just one catch. Years later, after all that had happened, it turned out the Riverside Miracle wasn't such a miracle after all.
Marketplace's Chrissy Clark on 20 years after welfare reform. More to come on the radio on this story and to hear the final twist in this particular story and how Larry's foray into the music business would make for some very surreal Senate hearings. You can subscribe to our new podcast from the Wealth and Poverty Desk. It's called The Uncertain Hour, and it is available wherever you choose to do your downloading. It's pretty good. Check it out. This final note on the way out today, a possible strategy change for the financially strapped United States Postal Service. The USPS is in some trouble, as you may have heard. Billions in deficits every year, more billions in pension liabilities. The Finnish post office, it turns out, is in the red too, but it has a plan. Starting next month, Posti, as the Finnish Postal Service is called, will start mowing customers' lawns. They're going to do it between May and August, Tuesdays only, though, because that's when actual mail volume is the lowest. As little as 65 euro, about $75 a month. Tell you what, man, sign me up. The Dow gave up 57 points today, about 0.3%. The NASDAQ off 30 points, 0.6%. The S&P 500 down 10 points, about 0.5%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Sitar Nieves. Deborah Clark is the vice president and the executive producer around here. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourselves a great weekend, everybody. We are back on Monday. This is APM. Hey, everybody, it's Kai. We wanted to introduce you to a new podcast from Marketplace brought to you by the Wealth and Poverty Desk. It's called The Uncertain Hour. You could think of it as a docu-pod. It dives deep into the uncertainties of our economy in ways you don't often hear. We think, well, we know, actually, you're going to enjoy it. Also, it's not actually an hour, more like, you know, standard podcast length, 20, 30 minutes.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.